Well, good evening, everybody. Good to see all the familiar faces, some unfamiliar faces, and even some strange faces. So, but you're all welcome. Thanks for coming out on a cold, crisp night. Those of you who are viewing this via the webcast, we welcome you too. As Paula approached me a few days ago, preparing for this event, she says, "David, do you need PowerPoint?" And I said, "No, but I do hope to make some powerful points." So we'll let you all be the judge of that. I don't know if you ever thought about it, but in so many ways, you and I are the beneficiaries of all those who came before us. We may not think about it very often, we may not be aware of it, but it is a fact. Without the dedication and sacrifices of those who came before us, this world and our existence would be greatly impoverished. Consider, for example, all the advances that have been made in medicine over the past 50 years, or the great increase in scientific knowledge made over the past 100 years. Or consider our system of jurisprudence, which has been developed not over 50 or 100, but several hundreds of years. Therefore, I think it's indeed fitting and proper that we should all feel a debt of gratitude to those pioneers who have extended the boundaries of human knowledge, and to those brave souls who stood up against the rigid orthodoxies of their day, often enduring ridicule, censure, and ostracism for their groundbreaking work. But we are not gathered here tonight to talk about medicine, science, or our system of jurisprudence. Instead, we have come to pay tribute to some of the custodians of the wisdom tradition, especially those who kept its flame burning, often at a very high personal cost. This tradition, as many of you know, has been referred to by many names: the ageless wisdom, esoteric philosophy, the perennial philosophy, or simply theosophy. At times, this tradition has flourished right out in the open, as it did in ancient Egypt and Greece in the mystery schools. Then, at other times, it was driven underground, as it had been during the centuries after the fall of the Roman Empire, when Europe was swept by a wave of ignorance and religious bigotry. But somehow, the teachings always survive. They always do. And these teachings, which were reintroduced to the world at the end of the 19th century by H.P. Blavatsky, they did not originate with her, as her critics would have us believe. In her introduction to The Secret Doctrine, which is arguably her greatest work, she responded to those critics who had accused her of having invented or fabricated the teachings. She responded by quoting the French philosopher Montaigne, who said this, quote, "I have here made only a nosegay of culled flowers and have brought nothing of my own but the string that ties them." Close quote. And so it was with HBB and the teachings. She brought nothing of her own, but simply brought all the pre-existing teachings together in one book called The Secret Doctrine. As she stated emphatically many times, this tradition, this esoteric tradition, has deep roots that go back centuries. And today, the teachings are available to us because of the labors of those who came before. In some cases, those who passed on the teachings made great personal sacrifices, often putting themselves in grave personal danger. And I'm particularly thinking of those brave souls who had the courage to stand by their convictions, sometimes even at the cost of their very lives. Sadly, history has recorded the death of more than one such martyr. And tonight, we shall pay tribute to three of them. Each of these three individuals placed the pursuit of knowledge and wisdom above all else. Each refused to conform to the intellectual and religious orthodoxies of their day. And it is true, while they had their friendly supporters or disciples or students, they also created powerful enemies. Because one cannot effectively challenge the conventional wisdom without sooner or later arousing the hostility of those who have a deep vested interest in the status quo. We know that's true today as it was then. But before I talk about these three heroic individuals, before I do that, let me acknowledge the debt of gratitude that all of us owe to Madame Blavatsky, or HBB as we like to call her. In the theosophical world, November 17th, that's just a few days from now, November 17th is Founders Day. That's a time when theosophists all over the world pay their respects to the founders of the Theosophical Society. Now, although Blavatsky was not martyred, she was certainly ridiculed, vilified, and slandered by her contemporaries. She put up with an awful lot. This tremendous opposition came primarily from two quarters. Number one, the religious establishment. Number two, the scientific establishment. The former was marked, that's the religious institutions, they were marked by intolerance and bigotry. And the latter, the scientific establishment, it was very materialistic at that time, and it had a godless and mechanistic view of the universe. But thankfully, in spite of such relentless attacks, she remained defiant. She never wavered. In the preface to The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky said this, and I quote, "It is written in the service of humanity, and by humanity and the future generations, it must be judged. Its author," that's HPB, "its author recognizes no inferior court of appeal. Abuse, she's accustomed to. Calumny, she is daily acquainted with. At slander, she smiles in silent contempt." And well might those very words have been spoken by each of the three great souls to whom we shall pay tribute in a few moments. Having thus given a tip of the hat to Madame Blavatsky, let me say that this talk is not your traditional Founders Day talk, for if it were, I would be talking either about Colonel Henry Olcott or the life of HPB, the two principal founders of the society. But instead, those of you that read the program know this, those of you that didn't, I hope you're not disappointed, but instead, I'm going to talk about three seminal figures from the esoteric tradition, a tradition with which Blavatsky championed and spoke of time and time again in her writings. So at this time, I'd like to call upon my special assistant to help make the transition from my introductory remarks to part one of the talk. I may be taking more applications for this job here in the future. Before I start, okay, Socrates lived from 469 BC to 399 BC. Before I start, especially those of you out in webcast land, a viewer's warning. If you have small children in the room, you might want to send them to bed, because this narrative tonight will be filled with tales of intrigue, conspiracy, violence, brutality, murder, and yes, even torture. So you've been warned. All right, of the three, The name of Socrates is certainly the most widely known. Everybody's heard of Socrates. His life overlapped with that of Pericles. Pericles was perhaps the most famous general and statesman of ancient Athens. This was a time of great cultural and economic growth, and it's commonly referred to as the Golden Age of Athens. You've all heard of that. Or sometimes as the Age of Pericles, because he was a prominent leader. And it was into this Golden Age that Socrates was born in the year 469 BC. He lived his entire life, or at least most of it, in Athens. And he was very devoted to his Athens. He loved his city, or polis, as they called it back then. You may not know this, though. In his earlier years, and you don't expect this for a philosopher, we think of a philosopher as somebody who sits around reading books or writing, leading a rather sedentary lifestyle. Socrates served in the military. More on that later. What we do know about Socrates today comes mainly from Plato, who was his most famous and illustrious student. The trial of Socrates, which Plato details in the Apology, that's one of the dialogues of Plato, that trial is without a doubt the most famous trial in all of Western history. And the death scene of Socrates is a second only to that of Jesus of Nazareth. So Socrates is very well known, even by people that haven't read the dialogues they've heard of Socrates. A little bit about Plato. Plato was much younger than his teacher, and he had been with Socrates about 10 years when Socrates' life came to an end. Then later, Plato went on to form his own school called the Academy, which is today considered the first university in Europe. Throughout most of his writings, the key figure was, as always, as you would expect, Socrates. He appears in all the dialogues, and it was Plato's way of paying tribute to the teacher whom he loved so very dearly. Back to Socrates. In his younger years, Socrates was an intellectual force to be reckoned with. But the philosophical mission for which he became famous did not begin until the second half of his life, probably in the early 40s or thereabouts. And during that second half of his life, he gladly assumed the role of a gadfly, the purpose of which was to challenge the conventional thinking of his day. He did this by employing his unique method of questioning and probing, which today is called the Socratic method. You've all heard of that. And like many great teachers of antiquity, Socrates left nothing in writing. But his style and method of inquiry are famously illustrated in Plato's dialogues. Scholars feel that those dialogues, the way Socrates puts forth the questions in the dialogues, that's very much the way he worked. So thanks to Plato, or shall I say because of Plato, the image of Socrates that has survived to this very day is that of the archetypal searcher. Okay, but what about Socrates the man? You know, the flesh and blood man. What about that? What was he like? Is it possible to separate the real man from this archetypal image? Well, we know for a fact that Socrates had a robust physical constitution. Both Plato and Xenophon is a contemporary Greek historian, a little bit younger than Socrates, they both refer to his extraordinary stamina and his powers of endurance, even at the age of 70. For example, his younger disciples would often tire and get bleary-eyed when the discussions went into the wee hours of the morning. But not Socrates. He apparently never tired of conversing, even after having done so for hours and hours. He had a lot of energy, a lot of stamina. As I mentioned earlier, he did serve in the military during his youth. And by all accounts, he compiled a military record that was exemplary. He was respected among soldiers, and he had a reputation for demonstrating great courage and quickness of mind in battle. So if you were a young man in ancient Greece and you were going into battle, you'd want to be close to a guy like Socrates. In the prime of his manhood, this is another example of his robust physical constitution, he used to wear the same single garment for both the winter and summer months. I don't know how hygienic that was, but I mean, he even went barefoot in the winter. And it's a further testimony to his physical vigor that when he died at the age 70, he had two small children, one of whom appeared to be an infant, according to Plato's remarks in The Phaedo. All right, that's so much for Socrates the man. Now, let's consider the significance of his contributions to Western thought and the remarkable way in which he met his death. Although he was something of a celebrity in Athens, Socrates lived a rather simple life. He did not covet money. He did not covet possessions. He didn't seek political power. He could have had any of those. He could have gone after them, but he chose not to. He sought wisdom. And he encouraged his students to look within themselves to decide what is important in life. Young men in their late teens who were thinking about what they're going to do with their life, what kind of a career am I going to have? Am I going to be a public servant? Am I going to go into the military? Am I going to be a teacher? He said, forget the conventional wisdom, go inside and decide. And you have all heard his famous maxim, the unexamined life is not worth living. So to Socrates, this was a sacred mission. It was a holy quest, something he took quite seriously. And throughout his life, another interesting fact, he would be seen sometimes standing for an hour in a fixed position. What he was doing, he was attuning himself to, and he called it an inner voice. And he trusted that inner voice with all his heart. Today, theosophists would say he was being in touch with his higher self. Throughout Plato's dialogues, there's a common theme that comes up. Socrates is asking, what does it mean to live a good life? How does one live a good life? And another theme that came up correlating to that is for a person who managed to live a good life, that person had nothing at all to fear from death. Nothing at all. Now, in spite of his popularity and his devoted followers, of whom he had many, he never portrayed himself as a as an authority like many teachers. In the Apology of Plato, Socrates said, and here I'll quote a short passage. Socrates says, according to Plato, I have never set up as any man's teacher. But if anyone, young or old, is eager to hear me conversing and carrying out my private mission, I never grudge him the opportunity, nor do I charge a fee for talking to him and refuse to talk without one. I'm ready to answer questions for rich and poor alike, and I'm equally ready if anyone prefers just to listen to me. End quote. Let's move to the trial. As I said earlier, the trial of Socrates is undoubtedly the most famous trial in all of Western history. As you may know, the charges brought against Socrates, which were heresy and corrupting the young, they were without foundation, utterly without merit. And guess what? Everybody in Athens knew that. They knew it. They knew this was bogus charges. These were bogus charges. But what you may not have known is that those who brought these charges against him never expected that it would go to trial. They didn't think it would get that far. And they certainly didn't think, if it went to trial, that it would lead to his execution. Never dreamed of that. No, their goal, the powers that be in Athens that brought these charges against him, people that had been offended and were irritated by his manner and style of his popularity, their goal was simply to silence him, to shut him up. They calculated that the mere threat of a trial would be enough to stop him from teaching philosophy altogether, or that he would voluntarily leave Athens and go into exile in some other city and teach philosophy there. That's what they thought, but they were wrong. That didn't happen. Socrates had too much integrity to turn his back on all that he believed in, merely because he was placed in a personal predicament. And he also, another point, besides his integrity, he had great respect for the law. And this is where this comes from. As a scholar A.E. Taylor said in his book, Socrates, the Man and His Thought, I quote, "It was no doubt from the spirit of Periclean Athens that Socrates derived the lifelong sense of the importance of implicit obedience to lawful authority, and, in the end, to submit to a trial, which it was intended by his accusers he should evade, and a sentence from which he might easily have escaped," end quote. And so it went to trial, to the surprise of many. Today we have juries of 12. Back then, it's a little bit bigger. The jury was 500. Imagine the jury selection process, 500. Well, as we all know, he was found guilty by a vote of 284. At the time of the trial, Socrates had two sons and a wife, but not once did he ever appeal to the court on their mercy. Oh, I'm a father, I have children, have mercy on me. He never did that. He held firm to his mission and his life's work, and that offended people. The death sentence then was announced, and normally it would have been carried out the very next day according to Greek law at that time. But due to a serendipity of the calendar, the very next day upon which he would have been executed, that was the start of a major holiday, which went for 4 weeks. So the execution was delayed for 30 days. He was placed into custody, but before I jump to that part, when the actual verdict was announced, the amazing thing is Socrates was very stoic. He showed no anger, no emotion, no bitterness. In the Crito, another dialogue, in the Crito, Plato has him saying this, quote, "It would be hardly suitable for a man my age to resent having to die." So while awaiting his execution, he had many visitors. He was deeply beloved by many people, so he had his friends come. His family would visit, his students, his followers. Every day, people would come to visit Socrates. And he had ample opportunity to escape. His friends would ask him to escape. "Go into exile. You have 30 days, Socrates. The trial was bogus. The charges were trumped up. Go, save yourself." He wouldn't do that. He said it would be undignified and a betrayal of all that he had said and taught throughout his life. Amazingly, even the jailer, the person who was charged with keeping him in custody, he became sympathetic and said, "Socrates," he was in tears, according to Plato, and the jailer said, "Socrates, I'll go out there, I'll turn my back, and while I'm gone, please go, get a boat, leave." He wouldn't. He was steadfast. He believed, Socrates did, that it would be showing disrespect for the laws of Athens, even though he disagreed with how those laws had been interpreted in his case. And again, in the Crito, he says, quote, "I cannot abandon the principles which I used to hold in the past simply because this accident has happened to me." When he believed in something, he was either all in or not at all. At the end of 30 days, then, when Socrates is handed the cup of poisonous hemlock, what does he do? He doesn't hesitate. He doesn't waver. But he quite cheerfully downs the liquid in one gulp. Plato describes the scene of all the people there. He was surrounded by people. Of all the people there, Socrates alone is calm, cool, and collected. Everybody else is a mess. His disciples are distraught, they're overcome with grief, they're crying, they're wailing, the women are wailing. So, you know, Socrates says, there's nothing to fear from death, they keep wailing and crying. Then he tries to lighten up the situation with a few jokes, that doesn't work. Finally, he gently chastises them and says, what are you making a big fuss over this? Then, after they've been admonished by their teacher, they get a grip on themselves, they become ashamed, and they manage to calm themselves for the last few minutes of his life. And so it was that Socrates distinguished himself by the remarkable manner in which he faced his own death, which is to say, fearlessly, cheerfully, and without reservation. Another remarkable thing happened, though, before he left. He tells his closest disciples that he's not afraid because he knows that the soul has immortality and it will live on. During all the dialogues, and they often discussed death and the soul, it was hypothetical. Is the soul immortal? What happens after we die? He never comes out and definitively says what he believes until a few minutes before he dies. And then he tells them, I have complete confidence, and I know, he says, that the soul is immortal, so have no fear. So, in short, this great man, this great teacher, distinguished himself then and now and for all times by the way he lived and by the way he died, which is to say, again, without hesitation and without trepidation. And now I'm going to request that my highly trained assistant make the segue to part two of our program. She makes it look easy, but it takes hours and hours of training. Hi, Pesha. Just out of fun, how many here, raise your hand, how many have heard of Hypatia? That's about what I thought, a few. You go into a normal audience, hardly anybody will raise their hand, but you guys being students of esoteric wisdom, a few of you have. Okay, so Socrates, he just passed away, it was 399 BC. Now we're going to leap forward in time about 800 years. We're going to travel south across the Mediterranean Sea to ancient Alexandria. At that time, Alexandria was a vibrant and thriving center of art, commerce, and intellectual activity. You might say it was the New York City of its time. It was a place to be. That was where all the hip people went, the movers and shakers, Alexandria. In that great city lived a great teacher by the name of Hypatia. She's not nearly as well known, so a few words are in order. Hypatia was born around 350, we're not exactly sure, give or take 5 or 10 years, 350 AD, about 800 years after Socrates, and she was killed in the year 415. I'll talk about how she was killed in a minute. First, some similarities. Just as Socrates lived his entire life in Athens, Hypatia spent her entire life in Alexandria. Like Socrates, she was also a respected teacher of philosophy. Her father, Theon, was a noted scholar and mathematician, and she had studied with him as a girl. Unfortunately, we don't have many details about her life, and what has been published is often a mixture of truth and legend. What scholars consider to be really factual about Hypatia comes to us in the form of a very few fragments that have survived antiquity. After her death, the story of Hypatia was ignored and forgotten for hundreds of years. In modern times, Hypatia first resurfaced in European literature during the 18th century, or the era of the Enlightenment. In the years that followed that, the character of Hypatia appeared in a number of dramatic works, including novels and theatrical performances. But each added their own embellishments and speculations to this composite figure known as Hypatia. As a result, it's very difficult to sort out fact from fiction. Now, conventional wisdom has it that Hypatia was a beautiful pagan philosopher, like a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, who was literally torn to pieces by an angry mob of monks. Now, you're going to expect me to debunk the conventional wisdom, aren't you? I'm not going to do that, because guess what? In this case, the conventional wisdom is right. She did possess great physical beauty, and she was murdered by fanatical Christian monks. And this is perhaps one of the reasons we have so little information about her. Because who were the historians? Christian monks. Yeah. Undoubtedly, they were a little bit embarrassed or maybe ashamed of the way that she was murdered by their own clerics. And therefore, out of shame, did not want to leave any written records describing that disgraceful event. Scholars say the most reliable source for information on Hypatia comes from Ecclesiastical History by Socrates Scholasticus. This is a different Socrates. This is a historian, a contemporary of Hypatia's, a little about 15, 20 years younger than her. Here's an excerpt from Ecclesiastical History. I quote, "There was a woman at Alexandria named Hypatia, daughter of the philosopher Theon, who made such attainments in literature and science as to far surpass all the philosophers of her time. Having succeeded to the school of Plato and Plotinus," meaning Neoplatonism, "she explained the principles of philosophy to her auditors, many of whom came from a distance to receive her instructions." Close quote. There's one other credible source for information on her teachings and also her students, and this comes from the epistles of Bishop Synesius of Cyrene. He was a student of Hypatia. He studied with her. The epistles include 156 letters in all. Here's just two short little excerpts. Quote, "She taught her students to regard philosophy as the most ineffable of ineffable things." And this, "She referred to innate spiritual powers as," quote, "the genuine guide, the eye buried within us, the luminous child of reason, or, my favorite, the hidden spark which loves to conceal itself." You recall, Socrates had his inner voice or inner guide. Hypatia had this hidden spark within. Sounds a lot like theosophists talk today, doesn't it? The voice of the silence. So, one other book I might mention. In her book, Hypatia of Alexandria, author Maria Dzulska describes the goals that Hypatia had for her students. These were her goals, and I quote, "The goal to which Hypatia was leading her disciples, the union with the divine, required both vast cognitive effort and ethical perfection. Wisdom alone was not sufficient. Hypatia taught them that to gain this insight, which is located on the fringes of knowledge, which recognizes only beauty, they must be beautiful themselves. They must be perfect." End quote. By all accounts, Hypatia was not an easy teacher. She was a taskmaster. She could be stern. She could be demanding whenever she felt that her students were falling short of the mark. And it was not beyond her to publicly embarrass or humiliate them if she felt that it was in their best interest. As I said earlier, her death was caused by a frenzied mob of Christian zealots who, after having ambushed her, dragged her through the streets, stripped her naked, beat her, and literally tore the limbs from her body. Apparently, these monks never got the memo on brotherly love. In Edward Gibbon's great work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Gibbon states that Bishop Cyril was behind Hypatia's death. You see, at that time, Hypatia was well known in the upper echelon of Alexandria. She was respected. She garnered a lot of attention. Cyril was extremely jealous of her. And that at that time, he held a position of great power and influence within the church. And Gibbon, in his book, says that the mob that killed Hypatia was encouraged and instigated by Cyril. If that is true, then Cyril was complicit in a conspiracy to commit murder. But his involvement in the death of Hypatia did not seem to have an adverse effect upon his career. Bishop Cyril is today known as Saint Cyril. Moreover, these monastic thugs responsible for her violent death were never punished. It may be hard to believe, but some people even go so far to suggest that the church engaged in a cover-up. Ooh, it's shocking, I know. All right, I'm going to ask my able-bodied assistant to help me out one more time as we move to the final part of this program. All right, dear, you can take the rest of the night off. You're done. All right, we now fast forward 1,100 years to the 16th century. Just as Socrates and Hypatia devoted their lives to philosophy, so did Giordano Bruno. But unlike the former, who never put anything into writing, much of Bruno's writings has survived and is still published today. And whereas Socrates and Hypatia lived their lives in just one city, Bruno spent much of his adult life traveling from one city to another, but more on that later. Let's begin with his early life. He was born in Italy in the year 1548. As a youth, his education took place in Naples. At the age of 17, he entered a Dominican monastery. This is where he was given the monastic name of Giordano. And I want you to know there's no truth to the rumor that his descendants have a pizza franchise in Chicago. It's different Giordano's. His studies were extensive, including the philosophy of St. Thomas, Aristotle, and the works of classical writers such as Virgil, Cicero, Seneca, and Ovid. He may also have discovered the works of Euclid and Ptolemy during his stay in the monastery. Bruno was also familiar with the works of Plato and often used mythological imagery in his own writings. In a word, he was well read. By the age of 23, he had distinguished himself as quite the scholar. He was invited to Rome for an audience with the Pope, which was quite an honor for a young man. But there were problems in paradise. His tempestuous personality, combined with his intellectual thirst for knowledge, eventually put him on a collision course with the monks in a monastery. So he was forced to escape at the age of 28 to avoid the Inquisition. During the next 16 years, he would travel and write, until he was finally caught and arrested and put into prison at the age of 44. What was it that made Bruno an enemy of the church? Why was he imprisoned and ultimately put to death as a heretic? Well, first, he was fearless. He was fearless in his vision of an infinite universe at a time when this view clashed with the views of the established order. It's probably very difficult for us now to imagine how radical some of the things were that he said during that time. For instance, he perceived the universe as a unity which embraced every individual soul and which pervades the whole of manifested nature. Nature, he said, is a living unity of living units, in each of which the power of the whole is present. You might recall that in The Secret Doctrine, Madame Blavatsky speaks of the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, thus echoing the view of Bruno. Secondly, he recognized that physical senses were fallible, but considered them indispensable tools in the search for truth. The findings of the senses, he believed, should always be subjected to the interpretation of reason. This position stood in stark contrast to the emphasis that the church placed on blind faith. It was also a precursor to the approach that would be taken during the scientific age, which was about to dawn on Europe. So he was a little ahead of his time in that sense. Bruno's philosophy was based on his vision of a boundless universe and an infinite number of worlds. Although this was not a new concept, for it is found in the writings of the Roman philosopher Lucretius 1,500 years earlier, Bruno took this view and articulated it and fleshed it out and gave it much more force. So again, in The Secret Doctrine, you find Blavatsky speaking of a boundless and immutable principle as one of the fundamental teachings of the esoteric philosophy. In his own words, Bruno described the universe this way, and this is a direct quote. "There are dissimilar finite bodies within a single infinity. Many continuous parts form a unity," end quote. In his view, in other words, free will was linked with knowledge. He claimed that if an infinite God created an infinite universe, then the divine will must reside in all things. And those of you who are theosophists might recall Annie Besant's mantra, "O hidden life, vibrant in every atom, O hidden light, shining in every creature." I think Bruno would like that mantra. Well, statements like these and the next one were considered heretical by the church. Here's the next quote. "That which resideth in the small may be seen in the great, and it appeareth that the part hideth everywhere in the whole." That sounds like the hermetic axiom, as above, so below. How about this quote? This one really caught their attention. "Beware the priest who would rank either divine freedom or our own freedom as merely contingent and possible," end quote. The key word there is contingent. I mean, guys, we're talking about salvation here. He's infringing on the church's exclusive franchise to salvation. The bad, bad thing to do. So is it any wonder that Bruno had a target on his back, or that he was a dead man walking? After he escaped from the monastery at 28, he began his travels. And I'll just talk a little bit about that. He traveled to all the intellectual centers of Europe, always looking for a receptive audience with whom he could share his then radical ideas. They're not radical today, but back then they most certainly were. You might even compare him to you might say that he was the medieval equivalent of the character played by actor David Janssen in the TV series, older folks will remember this, The Fugitive, ran for years and years on TV. David Janssen's always, he was innocent, but he was accused of a crime and he's trying to stay ahead. Well, in this case, Bruno wasn't a criminal, he's just an outspoken free thinker trying to stay two steps ahead of the Inquisition, and they were hot on his trail. In fact, if there had been air travel in his day, he could have racked up a lot of frequent flyer miles. Here's a quick summary. First, he flees to northern Italy, only stayed there briefly. It got too hot. Then he goes across the border to Switzerland, goes into Geneva, because he thought there's no Inquisition there. Well, what he found out is there's a rigid theology of Calvinism, which was still very strong. And one thing they frowned on was anybody questioning Aristotle. So he had to get out of there. He left Geneva, crossed the border of France to a little town called Lyons. That didn't work out too good, so he went to South France, went to Toulouse, stayed there for a while. Like all places that he went to, it became dangerous and he had to go to Paris. He chose Paris in 1582 because that's a rather cosmopolitan center, big city, it should be safe. There's intellectuals there. And he did. I mean, he was okay for a while, and he came to the attention of the bigwigs and the thinkers. He even came to the attention of King Henry I, who was very impressed. He had a personal audience with the king. And he said, "Brunel, I'm going to give you the chair of philosophy at the University of Paris." Brunel said, "Wow, this sounds really good." He said, "Only there's one catch. It's just a formality, you understand, but Brunel, you got to take the mass." Brunel wouldn't do it, so he had to get out of Dodge. This time he went to England. Again, he impressed the movers and shakers, the thinkers, the intellectuals. Wow, this guy is something. This Brunel is something. Elizabeth, the queen, was fascinated with him, got him into Oxford. He started teaching at Oxford. Well, the conservative thinking there raised an eyebrow. And it wasn't long before he had to leave Oxford. This time, he goes back to Paris just for 3 days, maybe to get a change of clothing, get some French cologne. He's off to Germany for a couple of years. 2 years later, he has to leave Germany. He goes to Prague. He stays there for a couple of years. All the time he's writing, and talking. It's 1590 now. He's back to Frankfurt, Germany, because he had to leave Prague. And that is where he published his very last works, his last manuscripts. Now, the year 1592, by this time, he had been gone for 16 years from his home in Italy. His family, his friends, he misses them. He's homesick, really homesick. He was tricked and betrayed by a friend of his who was living in Italy at that time, sent him a letter and says, "Brunel, I got your back covered. Come on down. It's okay. They forgot about you. They don't even remember who you are." It was just reeling him in because this guy had been bought off by the Inquisition. He trusted his friend, went down there. He was immediately arrested. Once captured, he was thrown into prison for 8 years. 8 years, having to endure harsh and cruel conditions, including the latest state-of-the-art methods of torture. And they were very diabolical, let me tell you. During those 8 years of imprisonment, they constantly were interrogating him, getting him to recant, to renounce his teachings and beliefs. Never did. He never abandoned his principles or convictions. Fearless and unmoved by anything that the church could throw at him. So it all came down to the last day. He knew this day was coming. They had hoped it wouldn't come to this, but it did. On the morning of February 17th, the year 1600, Brunel was bound and gagged. Why was he gagged? Because as they marched him to the public square where he was about to be burned, they didn't want this heretic to be talking to some of the innocent lambs on the side and maybe put funny ideas in their head. So, this heinous and despicable crime was instigated by the same church that claimed to represent the Prince of Peace, who in Palestine some 1600 years before said, "Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you." You have to wonder, what part of that message did they not get? So back to the march to the pier. As Brunel made his way to the public square where he was about to be burned alive, just like Socrates, his behavior was extraordinary. He never spoke, he never hesitated, he never showed any sign of fear. And all the while, these monks and clerics are, "Recant, recant, recant." He was going to die no matter, but they still wanted to save his soul from eternal damnation. "Recant, recant." He was like, "Get out of here. Get out of my face. I'm going to the stake, and I'm going to hold my integrity." So, although he was about to die in the most gruesome way, he did not recant. He walked tall, held his head high. He arrived at the spot of the execution and remained resolutely silent as they bound him to the stake and lit the flames. Giordano Bruno demonstrated the most uncommon courage as he remained true to his ideals until the very last. I'd like to conclude by making a couple of brief points. Students of the esoteric wisdom know that at some point you may be tested, not once, maybe several times. The nature of these tests may manifest as small incidents or challenges of great magnitude. We don't know. The 18th century English writer Samuel Johnson once said that martyrdom is the test. By that, I think Johnson was referring to the ultimate challenge that a disciple or initiate may face. Martyrdom is the test. And as we have seen from the examples of Socrates, Hypatia, and Bruno, they passed the test because they had courage in spades. They had integrity in spades. The Christian apologist C.S. Lewis put it this way. C.S. Lewis said, "Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point." Not just one of the virtues, but every virtue, when you are tested, courage is in there. So perhaps this is one reason why Aristotle considered courage to be the primary virtue, not a secondary, but a primary virtue. Because Aristotle believed that courage makes all the others possible. Well, whether we agree with Aristotle or not, there's no doubt that Socrates, Hypatia, and Bruno had it. Second point, my last point. Let us not take the wisdom tradition for granted. We should always remember that the unbroken stream of esoteric teachings has survived because of the sacrifices of those who came before us. The world being what it is, intolerance and bigotry will always be the adversaries of those who search for truth, at least for the foreseeable future. This sad fact of human nature is acknowledged by one of HPB's teachers when the Master K.H. prophesies that just as the distant past has had more than one Socrates, so the dim future will give birth to more than one martyr. So let us remember our debt of gratitude to all those who have given so much to keep this wonderful tradition alive throughout all the centuries. And we may also recall that the same Mahatma that I just quoted also said, with great irony, I might add, that ingratitude was not one of their vices, as though they had any vices. Well, on the other hand, perhaps it was not Aristotle, but Cicero. Cicero had it right, perhaps, when he said, "Gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but the parent of all others." Cicero, Aristotle. Well, regardless of who you agree with, Cicero that it was gratitude or Aristotle that it's courage, I think we can all agree that both courage and gratitude are indispensable character traits that would serve all of us well as we move forward on our spiritual journey. And I thank you.